Hello, welcome. It's good to see you guys. It's good to be here tonight. Hopefully, glad the weather held up just long enough for us to be able to get in here and not get wet. Although we really need the rain around here to be certain. Deuteronomy chapter 18 is where I want to study with you this evening, chapters 18 and 19. Bill and we were talking a little bit before services, and he kind of said, this section is kind of strange. And to be fair, there is some things in here that are a little bit different. We want to notice that it falls, we're still in the section of Deuteronomy where Moses is effectively preaching the law of Moses. Moses preaching his own law. He's reiterating the law in this second form to Israel as they're preparing to enter the land of Canaan. And he's touching on the majority of what we find in the law. Some of it's even in the same order, which is an interesting thing to sort of compare to. But enough about that. Let's actually get into the text and see what it was that we found when we read through. Okay, Deuteronomy 18 and 19. And we're breaking this up into sections. And the idea is, again, that we talk about what exactly is found in each of these sort of sections. And then we'll come back through and we'll talk about what should they have learned from that reading or that listening to that as Moses delivered it, and then applications to ourselves, and then we're going to try to move to the stuff that follows. I don't know if we have yet to get there. We're going to do our best. Deuteronomy 1, first, or Deuteronomy 18, what do we find in the first 8 verses? Okay, what do you see when you read through that?
Reminder of what?
Exactly. That's what we find. It sort of breaks itself up into two sections. The first, say, two-thirds of verses 1 through 8 deal with the priesthood specifically. You can see that from verse 1, the Levitical priests. Priests were all from the tribe of Levi, but not every Levite was a priest. Those that were priests, what was their inheritance according to the first few verses of chapter 18? Okay, so the way they were provided for was out of the sacrificial system, right, and out of the things they would Israelites would bring to the tabernacle and later to the temple, right? What is their inheritance? God. It's such an interesting phrase, isn't it? They shall have no inheritance among their brothers. The Lord is their inheritance. It's not the only time we see that. That's a common way of describing their what they were given. The other tribes inherited lands and so forth, but not Levi. Levi inherited the service and worship of God. It's a stunning parallel to today, where we are called a kingdom of priests, when really our inheritance is the same as Levi's. As Christians, we're not given an inheritance on this earth, a land or a nation. What we are given is the same thing Levi was given, the service and worship and devotion to God. So we have an interesting parallel there. God had chosen Levi out of all the tribes for this work. At the end, we have a bit of a description on Levites that would come from wherever they were located to serve at the temple and later, or tabernacle and later at the temple. Okay, when they came to do that, they would be equally provided for. There was no such thing as like Levites who would live there and they would be sort of upper crust, and then you got your country Levite who comes in to serve and he wouldn't be treated as well. That didn't go. Okay, all of them had to be treated equally in that situation. All right, 9 through 14, different topic altogether. What do you see? Right. Stay away from the things that are detestable. Does someone else have a different word in your Bible? Detestable is a great word for that.
Abominable.
Anyone else think of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? When you see abominable, that's my childhood. I mean, I grew up watching it, right? And the little elf was a dentist and all that. But three times, at least in the ESV, three times in that section, it's described as things that are abominable. Or whoever does these things. Now that's interesting. Not only the practice, but the one who does it is an abomination to the Lord. And he comes back because of these abominations. God is wiping out Canaan. Okay, he is wiping out the Canaanites. In this section, we know it's idol worship and we know it's abominable, but what are they trying to do by these abominable means? What's the intent behind what they're doing in these verses? What are they trying to accomplish? If there is an element of worship, but I think there's another common thread here. Okay, there's a big emphasis on omens and fortune telling and divination and necromancy and inquiring of the dead. It's all an effort to get some kind of revelation, whether it's about what's going on now or what's going to happen in the future, right? Who is Israel to turn to for that information? God. This is what organizes the section. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and put up 15 through 22 because that's the common link between the first section, 9 through 14, and then 15 and following. Okay, 15 and following is an amazing section. We're going to talk about it at length here in a moment. But you have this contrast between here are all of the ways you don't look for revelation, right? Fortune telling, omen seeking, and all this other, versus God will raise up for you a prophet. Yes, sir.
These people were also looking for a way to engage for telling people that they were going to hear.
Okay.
And that
certainly
lead to them going with God.
Certainly. I mean, even today, to be a psychic? It's a business. There is a reason for it. Psychics are, I don't know, I could go far down that road, but I'm not going to. You have this contrast between looking for information in all the wrong places and the right place to go look for it, right? From God, from someone designated by God to go speak. Okay, Levi, did you have a comment?
If you're hanging out with people that do that kind of thing, they're probably not encouraging you to look for it
from God. More than likely, no, right? They're looking at any number of weird and crazy things. There is a test within this section of the true prophet. What is it? How do we know it's a true prophet?
What he speaks must come to pass.
What he says has to happen. Okay. Now, is this like, you know, National Enquirer or the Nostradamus, right? He makes 10,000 prophecies and one of them happens? No, right? The test is very cut and dried. If anything they say should happen, doesn't, or, you know, won't happen, will, or does, they're out. Right. We saw that earlier. I believe it's in Numbers. I have to go look at it again. But the test for this was whether or not their word came to pass. Okay. In that section, there is an element of fear that I think runs throughout that. Why did God send them prophets in the first place? You didn't want to hear it from him directly. And so you get this retelling of the story of what happens at Sinai. God says, you remember what happened when I spoke to you directly? You shook in your sandals and begged Moses not to, don't let him do that again. You go talk to him, bring us back the message, lest we hear it and die. Right? So there's a practical side of this. It's because of their fear of God that they need a prophet. They would fear what the prophet's words if he spoke on God's behalf. Right? The power the prophet had was because he was delivering God's message. Okay? It wasn't because of who he was as a person. Okay? We have prophets who were royalty. We have prophets who were shepherds. Right? Tender of sycamore figs. It's because of the message. And only the true prophets had to be listened to and had to be feared. Okay. 1 through 13. Big section, but it all sort of has one thought. Or, sorry, 19, 1 through 13. That's exactly it. That's all I said. This is the description of what the cities of refuge were going to be. Okay, we found this earlier. We studied this earlier when we went through the law, or as we were going through the law a little bit earlier. Why are there only three cities set up here? I thought there were six.
Wasn't it based on their expansion?
Okay.
Their
Which, the three cities he's talking about here, where would they be? You're exactly right, but where would they be? East of the Jordan River, or west of the Jordan, right? Yeah, west. Did I do that right? Yeah. West of the Jordan. The eastern cities have already been established because the eastern tribes have already been given, you know, the 2.5 tribes, they already have their land. So those cities are already done. They're preparing to enter Canaan, cross the Jordan. They're going to need 3 more cities. The rules for that have already been established. Even where the cities are going to be have already been established. But we have this repetition of this, okay, as well as a retelling of the concept of the manslayer. If someone were to kill someone by accident, okay, what were they to do? Run to the city of refuge. Why not walk at a leisurely pace? Someone could come kill you and be justified in doing so. Why would they be justified? Why would the avenger of blood, as he's called earlier, why would that person be justified? Well, killed on purpose, that person died, category, all the time. But,
I mean, they may have said he did it on purpose.
Right.
They're out to offend that.
There's a concept that tells us why the Avenger of Blood wasn't condemned for killing a manslayer. Did you have your hand up? There's a really old concept when it comes to someone killing another person. Blood for blood, right? Genesis 9 and verse 6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Killing someone, even accidentally, did not set that part aside. If that person were found, that person died, whether he meant to kill or not. It's a very old concept. Now, in Israel, God had a saving grace against that eventuality, and it was the city of refuge. If someone, even as it says in the text, you know, goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down a tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor. I mean, talk about an incredibly unlikely thing. You know, God recognized there's no intent there. He will make a way for that person to be protected from something he had no control over, provided he could make it to the city. If the person did it on purpose, what happened? No pity. What if they make it to the city? You drag him out of it and kill him. Right? God recognized intent here. There would have been an investigation. The elders of the city drag him out and they hand him over and he dies. Right, your eye, it says, there shall not pity him. Okay, verse 14. I know what Bill's saying about this is kind of an odd section because it literally does bounce from subject to subject. What do we see in only verse 14? Don't move your neighbor's landmark. Wait a minute. What was the landmark? How'd they define where territory was? Right. And that's the big reason why this law really, really matters. I'm thinking, practically speaking, how would they know where the border of one land stopped or another one stopped? Like, how would they keep up with it? God established where those would be. This is before GPS and surveying, so there's a post, there's a rock, there's something there. More than likely a stone, right? Stones don't rot, they don't tend to blow away. So the problem here is, what if it gets moved? Right? You think, I have another 3 foot worth of land. It wouldn't happen like that, but It's actually an incredibly important law. Here's how important that law was. If you have your Bible in front of you, look over at Deuteronomy 27. Deuteronomy 27, the curses that were pronounced on Mount Ebal. You remember we had Mount Gerizim where the blessings were pronounced, and you had Mount Ebal where the curses of the law were pronounced. And you had the tribes split up half on either mountain. Look at verse 17. Alongside such sins as, in verse 15, making an idol, bowing down to it in secret, misleading a blind person on the road, perverting justice, lying with your father's wife, alongside all of that, what do you see? Don't move the landmark. This law mattered a lot. They all mattered. Some were critically important. This was one of them, to be able to respect the boundaries. It's so important. Proverbs 22:28, Proverbs 23:10. I think I have these on the notes, so I'll flash them up here in a minute. These are all ways used to describe wicked people, people who move the landmark. In Hosea 5 and verse 10, it's used again as a description of someone who's exceedingly wicked, someone who moves the landmark. All right. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Last section, 15 through 21. What do you see? Witnesses. How many witnesses do you need?
More than one.
More than one. Right. Two or three, of course, implied that more would be okay. If a malicious witness arises and accuses a person of wrongdoing, what do you do to them? When you find out they have broken it. Yes, sir? There could be a situation where they would be killed. Okay. What's the kind of the rule that governs what do you do to him?
Whatever he was falsely accusing the other person of is what his sentence shall be.
Exactly. The penalty that that person would have had is applied instead to the false witness. All the way up to, if it's a capital crime, like Ty said, he dies. Okay. Did you notice the familiar phrase at the end of the chapter? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We've seen that before, right? We saw that in Exodus. We saw it in Leviticus. I'll have the notes here in just a second. Cool. All right. Now, what did you notice when you went through? Yes, sir. Kick us off. You got to speak up, remember. Ty, speak up. Yeah, you're exactly. So I'll paraphrase, or I'll summarize what he said so well. He said all through this section, and we're dealing with the rules that God has for Israel. Amen to that. He says he's giving them these rules not because he's mean to them, but he wants them to learn respect for God. And I can't argue with that. Along with that, respect for one another. This is how you treat other Israelites. Okay, this is the way you're supposed to be going about that. So absolutely, fantastic. All right, what else did you see or did you notice as you read through something? Yes, sir. Go ahead. You're next. Go ahead, Levi. It was a farce, yeah. The Gospels even go so far as to say they kept bringing witnesses, and they couldn't find two of them that agreed with one another, and so they kept doing it until they finally got two that did. And it was specifically the tearing down the temple comment Jesus had made. No, there's... Here's the irony of Jesus' trials. The only fair trial he had was in front of a Gentile. And the Gentile found him innocent and tried to set him free. And that'll tell you just how backwards they were at that point. Absolutely. That's excellent. Yes, sir.
In 16, when Moses said to them, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord,
mm-hmm.
when they said, and then God said, they're right, he told them there would be a prophet like Moses to raise up, letting them know that when Moses wasn't there, there would still be someone that would represent God for them and in front of God.
That's exactly right. And that gets fulfilled many times. It gets fulfilled in its ultimate sense much later. And we're going to talk a lot about that because it's one of my favorite passages. But this gets fulfilled repeatedly. You think of Samuel, you think of Elijah, you think of others in that category.
Kind of state the obvious, but I can't imagine before, even after, a society existing in any capacity like this.
Absolutely.
So, they didn't stick with it, but had they, if we think about our civil laws and justice and the scales of justice and all the different attributes of government, but that aside, this is a system that would absolutely work.
Absolutely it would. It's beautiful. I mean, when you really get into it, and like we've been doing, and you really think about it, this is amazing.
Really, I mean, at the highest level, the Supreme Court, it's never going to be wrong, right? Because it's God.
Yep. Yep.
There is no going wrong. You can't elect the wrong person for president, appoint the wrong person, or whatever the case may be. It's always going to be supreme. It's always going to be perfect.
That's an excellent point. The more you study it, the more that line God says about, the nations are going to hear this and they're going to respect you. They're going to be like, something's different over in Israel. That starts to make more sense the more you read about what they were supposed to do. Absolutely. All right. Anybody else? Any other? Yes, ma'am. And then I guess you're next after that.
Innocent blood, that phrase, innocent blood.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's life. It's that thing God breathed into us from the beginning, and it's precious. And it's always defended by God. Always defended by God. And when it's taken away, something must give. There is no, it must be reckoned for. And that should tell us something about that. Did you have another one?
No, Josh was talking about the society that's done. Kathleen and I are taking a constitutional study on every Thursday for 6 weeks. The first thing that the founding fathers did was affirm that the Ten Commandments were the guide.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
Yeah.
I come from Mount Sinai itself. So.
Yeah, the founders recognized in our own country that the Constitution would only be successful if it were to a moral people already. Like, to a people that already had a huge framework of right and wrong and what that was based on being Scripture. You throw the Scripture part out, and, it's inadequate, really, for what it needs to be. All right. Excellent, excellent, excellent. There may be others. Me, time's always against us. Just an organizational note. This section of Deuteronomy, you have the big institutions of Israelite life. Here are the big things you as an Israelite are going to deal with. Here's how you as a people are going to be organized. You're going to have a judicial system. The head of that system, as was mentioned earlier, is God. God as he directs that highest court in Israel. You have the kings who they would eventually appoint, whom God was perfectly okay with them having. The story over in 1 Samuel is about why they wanted it at the time. That's the issue there. And then you have priests and Levites, and you have prophets. This is an organized, informed, directed people. There wasn't a sense where an Israelite would go, I really just don't know what to do. There was some level of assistance there, of knowing what to do and being led. I mentioned this a moment ago. When we look at Canaanite methods for trying to figure out what God wants or what the gods want, they're all just all described by the same word. It might be detestable, it might be abomination or abominable. The strongest possible language to say, this is not what you need to be doing. Right? This is not how you need to try to figure out what I want from you. I noticed also going through, often when you see the grouping of the meat, the grain, the wine, the oil, the fleece, those are almost always in sections dealing with, here are your blessings you're going to get when you come to the land, right? Alongside blessings as, you know, your flocks are going to be plentiful and your children and that kind of thing. That's typically where you read this grouping or some version of it. In this section, God is going to give that to the Levites and to the priests also. It wasn't a situation where all of Israel is going to prosper and the priests and Levites are just going to get by on what's left. They're going to have everything every other Israelite has. They're going to get it by different means and for a different reason, but they're going to be blessed as well. Couple more things. There's a common phrase that you read over and over and over and over again. Some version of, you shall purge the evil from your midst. It's a constant refrain that God is saying, I'm going to clean the evil out of you. It never really reached that point. Right? It was a continual need, a continual process. But if they followed the law, this was the idea. We're getting rid of evil. We're making pure. We're sanctifying. We're making holy. And that follows so many laws. You can see here, just in tonight's text, in 19 verse 19, and then you see versions of it all over the book. Hear and fear also is something you see repeated a lot in Deuteronomy, a few times in tonight's section, and again, moving a little further along. Okay, Israelite reading this, hearing this said to him or her, what should they learn? What should they come away with? What conclusion would they come to having heard this section? Absolutely.
There's checks and balances. There's sustainment. It's a thriving economy.
Everything's taken care of. And they don't have to have a convention to sit down and figure it all out. God just says, here you go. Here's the perfect society on a platter. Here. Just go do it. You know. No sitting in a room with other people trying to figure it out for ourselves. Here is the perfect society. Go live it. Absolutely. Be comforted by that. What else should they have saw? Yes, ma'am.
I think, you know, the certainty of that society is really, really important. Like, it also
With God's law, there isn't a, I didn't know, and there isn't a, you led me in the wrong direction. If you do, you are led in the right direction. Now, I like how you mentioned that there should be an element of fear here. This isn't a fear of God because he's malicious and we're afraid he's going to hurt us just because he can. There is a fear of, this is a holy God we're dealing with, and we now understand his will, and it's for our benefit, but if we don't follow it, there's a danger there, and I need to get right. I need to be right with him, certainly. Yes, sir.
Well, so many times we've seen that phrase where God tells them, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt.
Yep.
And then that's always followed with some type of instruction, some type of reminder that it strikes me that if I was listening to that, well, he brought us out, but we're not left on our own. kind of telling us what to do now, how to do now. And if I think, wow, I'm thinking about all of those things he did to the Egyptians and parted the Red Sea, and our parents' clothes didn't wear out, some of our clothes didn't wear out. He provided food for 40 years, and I think he means it.
Yeah, they are still eating manna when these words are said. And, you know, I sometimes call it, you know, magic bread from heaven, but that's what you have. And, yeah, just understand what God can do.
And they've got it. It's got to be some sort of context. The reason, you know, that it would have perturbed me as we wandered the wilderness for 40 years. But then you realize the reason that happened is because 10 spies told us how we were going to get our hats handed to us when we try to go into there. And God keeps telling them, I'm going to get rid of them. I'm going to get rid of them. I'm going to get rid of them. You know, when you think about what he has done and what he tells you he's going to do, I'll take Josh's word. There's a lot of confidence there. It's not empty words. I mean, he just took the most powerful nation existed at the time and just demolished them.
Yeah, just kind of took their army and just sort of wiped them away or washed them away. I want to draw a parallel to something in chapter 18. So you have a prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name. Or in other words, a prophet who is saying what he or she is, they're claiming to speak on God's behalf, or they're claiming to know what the right thing is and to say it. Isn't that the sin of the 10 spies in a way? They never got up and said, this is the message from God, but they got up and they said, well, we never win. We're like grasshoppers to them. They listened to the wrong people. And in 18, you have this, here's who you need to listen to, right? Make sure you're listening to the right source of information. God's will is going to be delivered through proper channels. Whether that be through the priest, whether that be through the prophet, if his judgment is delivered through a judge, you're going to understand God's will and you're going to get it from the right place. Those who are devoted to God are provided for by God. This is a lesson for all Israel. They're all, in a sense, devoted to God, as the Levites are. Maybe not in the same fashion, but in the same way, God's going to provide for them. Okay? It's telling that God can take an entire tribe and say, you don't get any land, but don't worry about it. You're going to be provided for. I mean, that's at least some percent overage that all the tribes are going to be able to enjoy. The people could establish themselves whether or not a prophet was telling the truth. They didn't have to have an agency telling me the prophet's telling me the truth. It's just, did the prophet's word come true? Okay, that means they're a true prophet. You would have had indications that God knows their heart. God is aware of intent. He's aware of whether you slew your brother willfully or by accident. Along with that, we mentioned this already, life must be precious. If the avenger of blood catches you before you make it to the city, oh well, Genesis 9. You know, there was a provision for you, but there was an older law in place that holds precedent here, or that kind of trumps that. If that's the case, that's what's going to happen. All right, I told you I wanted to get to the prophet, and I am going to get to the prophet. I'm going to do it by magically moving forward. The prophet in Deuteronomy chapter 18. This is going to be fulfilled several times after Moses. There would be prophets raised up who would speak on God's behalf. Jesus would be the ultimate fulfillment of who this would be. In a lot of ways, he would be not the last prophet, but the greatest one. No other prophet had a prophet sent before him to announce he's going to show up. If nothing else, that means Jesus is the highest one. Just some parallels here. The same way Moses led Israel, Jesus led his followers, and he did something Moses could never do. He led them beyond the grave. Moses worked signs and wonders. Jesus worked many more signs and wonders. Jesus spent time in God's presence. As Moses spent time in God's presence, Jesus did a full body version of Moses' face on the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember that? When Moses came down the mountain, his face shone and they were afraid of him. Jesus did the the whole thing. And then in that context was standing there talking with who? Moses and Elijah, the two greatest prophets in the Old Testament, you might say. All right. Jesus must be the greatest one. The people around Jesus understood this is who Jesus was. Okay, you have here the quotation from John 1, verse 45. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote." They were looking for an ultimate fulfillment of the person from Deuteronomy 18. They understood this person that would come was the prophet to be listened to. The Messiah, you might say. Philip found Nathanael and says, "We've found him." When Peter is preaching in Acts chapter 3 to the Jews there, he quotes Deuteronomy 18. He's referring to Jesus, right? And he says, "Moses said," and then you have the quotation, right? "All the prophets who have spoken from Samuel and those who came after him also proclaim these days." So then Jesus is the one you've been looking for, right? From Deuteronomy 18. Some other parallels, prophets were expected to be listened to. How much more is that true of Jesus? You know, who repeatedly said things to the effect of, "You need to listen to me." He gave commandments. He gave orders and instructions and directions. And he said often, "It's the one who listens to me. It's the one who..." Jesus said over and over, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." He kept saying, "I'm the prophet. You need to listen." You know, I'm always reminded... They are told in Deuteronomy 18, "Whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him." That's Deuteronomy 18 and verse 19. Right? Now think about that in light of Jesus. God will require of each person if they do not listen to the prophet that was sent. If they do not listen to Jesus. You know, Jesus' teachings are not just, "Well, he was a good teacher, and we're going to take what we want from him." No, Jesus spoke with the same authority as Samuel and Elijah and Moses, you know, and more. So there's a requirement to listen to him, and we must do that. Okay. Last and final thoughts. I'm not even going to try to get to the questions, but yes, sir.
For some reason, it just comes back to a thing that Jesus said.
Yep. Being provided for from the people became profitable, became a way to accumulate wealth rather than just be provided for. They came to abuse that, certainly. And it wasn't just them. I mean, it was abused across the board, you know, by everybody, but you had the people bringing in sacrifices that were lame. You had that going on. I mean, all kinds of stuff, but certainly. All right. Any other comments, things you want to bring up? This is a great time to ask that question, you know, that's going to take 20 minutes and I can't do.
In regards to the intent of the heart, mm-hmm. and also the portion about the prophets who inappropriately spoke in God's name, there's kind of an interesting God's okay to build the temple, but God never gave him the authority to do that. And I brought up the intent of the heart because I don't believe at any point in time that they were meant to be disrespectful or out of the ordinary for them to say that.
Right.
But we know that he was very smoothly corrected.
Right. He got his attention and said, no, that's not the case. God certainly understands this. I'm going to throw this in right at the end, just concept-wise. This idea of two or more witnesses, it's used again in the New Testament. It's the foundation for how one is to bring an accusation if there is a need for one against an elder. The same principle is carried over, at least in some form, from the Old Testament. That's 1 Timothy 5, verse 19. There are other versions of this. I think there's maybe even a version of this, you know, if your brother sins against you, go to him alone. And then the next time, take two or three with you. Not exactly parallel, but you can see there's a similarity there. Right? There is a need for accumulating witnesses or help. You see that in the Old Testament. You see it again in the New Testament. I would really encourage you to look up the moving the landmark thing. It's a really big deal. Under Roman law, if you move someone's landmark, you died. Okay, so even in the time of Jesus, they understood. You move the landmark, you're done. Right, you die.
That's been carried forward in our current law.
Yeah.
It's a civil effort a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. We have better ways of keeping up with boundaries, well, somewhat, than they do. But yeah, big deal. Okay, thank you guys so much for your comments, and look forward to next week, which should be 20 and 21. All right, if you're able to be with us, we'd love to see you.